Afternoon. It's a very pleasant autumn time. The Sangha has been on retreat for the past week, and so it's been very peaceful week because of that. We spend time in there. We've been using the retreat center and been spending hours in silent meditation together, and that seems to, you know, be very useful thing to be doing as a community, to have periods of silent meditation. It'll end actually on Wednesday. Because in the summertime we get quite busy with a center like this. It's we have a lot of activities, and therefore everybody gets kind of stretched this way and that. So then we have to practice what we preach. So the subject for this afternoon is, how can I get rid of my anger? And anger, I think, is a basic human emotion that many of us, that all human beings feel. And many people are frightened of their own anger, because, of course, it's a destructive emotion, desire to destroy or annihilate, and that turns towards oneself or towards others. And a civilization, say Western civilization, sometimes we try to live up to a kind of idealism of kindness and not showing anger, not displaying anger. And because of that, we don't quite know what to do with it, with the actual feeling, because we certainly feel it, even though we may not know how to, say, integrate that kind of energy, that kind of experience. So we either end up following it by exploding and saying all kinds of things we regret later, or we can suppress it and reject it so that it doesn't appear in a conscious form. Many people have developed ways of just not admitting it, not even recognizing it when they are angry, not being able to even say, I'm angry or I feel anger. The defenses against it can be so highly complicated and strong to keep even the awareness and admission of its presence out of our conscious experience. One thing, you know, we could start contemplating our own humanity, what it really is like to be a human being, man or woman, living on this planet, because we find ourselves here in this very vulnerable form and sensitive condition, and it's frightening when you start kind of contemplating what it is to have to live in such a vulnerable and delicate state and such a sensitive condition as a human body, a human conscious experience. Sometimes we aren't really aware of it in a direct way. We might be reacting to it, and we certainly, fear is a kind of basic human emotion that drives us. Fear is something that is quite a normal experience. because there's a lot to be frightened of. Being in such a stage as this, we can, just on the level of survival, there's a lot to fear. You know, just and say before civilizations took off and put the animal kingdom under control, you realize so much of early human existence was just an attempt to protect oneself from the wild animals around. Imagine what it was like to live in Britain 3,000 years ago. And your problem wouldn't be with motor cars or serial killers, but with bears, wolves, things like that, or just other human tribes, people, bandits, and roving raiders, people that usually men that would go around trying to steal and rob and pillage. So of course the fortress structures down in the Hammer Wood in Chithurst, there's in West Sussex, there's an ancient Iron Age fort right in the forest where the monks live. They built Kuti right in the Iron Age fortress. You never know it was such, and you have to be. It has to be pointed out because it doesn't really look like anything, but it was actually excavated in the 50s as an Iron Age fort, which was a place where people at that time could keep their cattle and they lived on hill tops and with ramparts where they could kind of defend themselves from marauding tribes and wild animals. And so that's its basic survival on the level of, say, primitive humanity, where life was very much an attempt for survival and to get food and to protect your own family, your own group. So that's a natural kind of fear, isn't it, to fear the wild animals or the forces of nature, and the thunderstorms and the floods and the earthquakes and whatnot that are inevitable part of our life, experience of life on planet Earth. There's recently the earthquake in India. I mean, they say up to 30,000 lives just suddenly destroyed in a few minutes, due to nobody's fault, was it? It was just because something in the earth collapsed or trembled, and there went 30,000 people. A contemplated fear, because sometimes we are modern, Western, educated human beings tend to take everything in a kind of as if it shouldn't be that way, as if somehow fear shouldn't be a part of our life, that it's a neurosis or it's something wrong with myself because I experience fear. But when you contemplate the nature of existence and the way it is, then you realize that fear is definitely part of our survival system. It's a warning signal. It's what gets us going when we pick up the signs of danger. When you're aware of your own, you know, something turns on automatic pilot when your life is threatened. If any of you have ever had life-threatening experiences, it's quite amazing how rapidly you can move and how quick you can find your way out of a difficult scene when your life is in danger. When we think about it in terms of what would I do if, then we tend to get really we tend to think in terms of I wouldn't know what to do, or I couldn't bear it, or I couldn't stand it. But the remarkable thing is that when the actual experiences come, we find all kinds of resources we aren't aware of going into full operation, and we find ourselves, you know, being able to run faster than we've ever run before, and to do things that we wouldn't possibly think when we're in a comfortable situation like this that we would be capable of doing. Remember one friend of mine when I was in the military told me he'd seen a woman in, he was from Hawaii, and he's saying one time he saw this lorry had run over a child, and it was the lorry was right on top of the child, and the woman, ordinary kind of woman, the mother, the child, lifted the lorry off the body of her own child. Just because at that time, there's something, you know, I don't think any of us would think that would be possible when we're sitting in a room like this. But yet, under those circumstances, obviously something else was operating in the mind of that woman. Not her normal personal view of herself, but something, you know, very powerful and primordial to save or protect her own child. I think where fear, we become neurotic, is especially in, we get confused by the signs, in a, like in much of modern middle class life, where we've say been able to develop a lifestyle around comfort and security, a seeming kind of apparent safety exists around us, where we feel we can a kind of relax and there's nothing really to worry about, but then we start worrying about possibilities. We become anxiety ridden, worried over possibilities of being hurt or what we love being taken away from us or all kinds of things that we can think about or imagine that could happen to us. When we put our confidence and our trust and faith in the conditioned world with the bodies we have and the material situation we live in and the society we live in, we can and that is our refuge, that is all we know, and that's what we subscribe to as our is what we want to identify and cling to, then whenever any of those things are threatened, there's a tremendous anger and resentment about anything that's strange or alien or different coming along that might disrupt or destroy or change what we have regarded as our right or our life that we want to maintain and protect. It's interesting to hear about the attempts of people to protect preserve or protect their own position or their own countries or groups, and oftentimes it ends up with a total destruction of what they have been trying to protect. It's interesting to see how, you know, in wars, aren't they, where you're trying to maybe develop or protect or create the great empire or the superpower, whatever, trying to get more, to give yourself a sense of greatness by conquering and taking over other people's land. And the result is, of course, the destruction. Now we can see war is just an endless complexity. And we look at places like Somalia, which everyone thought was a very simple thing, you know, just go in there and feed those poor starving people. What seemed to be the initial reason for invading Somalia. It all seemed a very good thing to be doing. And then it becomes increasingly more complicated. Because the ideal is certainly a good one, but oftentimes we don't understand all the complexities underneath the surface. And especially, it's very difficult, I think, for people that live in countries like this, Western democratic systems, to really understand the problems of, say, people of a different culture, or people living in still in tribal situations, or the mentality or the way of thinking or the aspirations or the values of those people, because it's so easy to think that everyone shares your values and thinks like you do. So America sometimes it's a thing, you know, rushes into things only to find itself stuck in a quagmire, not knowing how to get out without being humiliated. See how they get out of Somalia this time. With all President Clinton's kind of sympathy for the Bosnian Muslims, he didn't ever really commit himself to doing anything about it, because he probably knew the once you start, once you get involved, you don't know what's going to happen. And the emotions and the anger and resentments that give people energy to carry on a war, even against a superpower that's superior in every way in terms of weaponry and war ability to fight. And yet this kind of dedicated anger or nationalist or political zealousness or fanaticism is an energy that is quite overwhelming, isn't it? It can go on and on and on. Anger is a very powerful energy. It's when you're angry, you can your strength increases, your mind, the sharpness of your critical mind, gets very intense. Everything becomes heightened through anger, rage. It's very exciting. Anger is a very exciting emotion. And and because it is so exciting, it's so strong, it frightens us. For those of us who feel, who don't really want to be involved, don't want to get involved in that kind of emotional activity, either with someone else or with our own anger, we can be very frightened by the power of our rage. I know I've been quite overwhelmed sometimes by the power of rage that can go through the mind. Because you think of yourself, I think of myself as a kind of gentle, nice guy, really. This emotion, certainly, nothing gentle or nice about it. Anger also turns inward, and when we don't know how to regard it, how to respond to that energy, it tends to eat us up or wear us out. It's just the attempts to suppress and reject it and control it. And the guilt and the self-aversion that come from exhibiting angry behavior. Because we tend to say awful things, mean-hearted, nasty, painful, malicious things when we're angry. And most of us don't like to say those kind of things. And yet, when one's angry, it seems the right thing to be doing. To tell somebody off, put them in their place, let them have it, full blast. Being an American, of course, we're more kind of, our society is much more prone towards displaying this emotion than here in Britain, and making confrontations and expressing anger seems to be, and confronting people in a very direct way, seems to be, you say, living here in Britain now for so many years, I've become more like the British. But I remember when I first came, it was sometimes quite baffling to me, because my American expectations were sometimes confounded by the kind of absence of that kind of confronting, direct approach that one expects from people in the States, and which you don't get very often here in Britain. In Thailand, it was also quite baffling, because Thailand is anger is not expressed. It's not. It tends to be. It's a country based on saving face, on not on a kind of avoiding it, on non-confrontation of issues, so that there's all kinds of, even the language allows for euphemisms and ways of getting around things that to say to an American can seem even hypocritical, because we want to say, well, let's face it, what do you think of me, what's wrong, this, and we would be very prone to say, well, my thing. Where in Thailand you wouldn't. You would say, you'd speak round about the situation, but not in a direct way. And so these are, you know, different ways cultures and civilizations tend to deal with this common human emotion. We can see some people can restrain, so that they have a kind of inscrutable a physical appearance that doesn't show any sign of emotion. And in Thailand, that's very much what happens, is people tend to not show it. I mean, the Western people are so surprised sometimes when a Thai person does get angry, because it's like out of thin air. They don't give the signs that would warn us. If you were berating an American and berating a Thai in the same way, the American would definitely, you'd know what to expect, and you'd certainly get the signs by the physical expressions and body language of the person, and which would be quite different than, say, in Thailand. But the emotion is the same. It's just how do we control it? How do we integrate it? Or how do we repress it? Because it is a part of our life. It's something that everyone feels, and that also needs to be understood. Something that can be integrated into one's, say, experience, and that energy can be transmuted from just blind destructive energy or the repression of it, to developing, say, mindfulness, wisdom, understanding of Dhamma, or things as they are. Now, anger always implies a lack of patience, too. I mean, we tend to be angry because we're impatient, or we can't get what we want, or we feel... We feel like a child throwing a tantrum when it can't get what it wants. It screams and yells, stomps its feet. And I've noticed when one is a very fast person and likes things done quickly, one gets very angry with slow people. Or if you like things done in a certain way, in a certain order, then one gets very angry if somebody does it in a different way. Living in a community is a good way to begin to understand the force of anger, because you're having to deal with living closely with a number of people who do things in their own way, and you have various levels of aversion, rage, anger, and exasperation. Very, very energizing. Sometimes people avoid community life or marriage or anything because they couldn't cope with the frustrations of having to live with somebody else or with a community, because one has to, they learn how to deal with this. If you're going to survive it, you have to learn how to deal with this force. Otherwise, you can't stay. You can't live together for very long. And so, in meditation, practice of meditation, mindfulness, developing wisdom in our lives, anger is very much a teacher for us. One thing I found it very helpful to change my attitude towards anger, which was based on my conditioning. The conditioning of my background was, I came from a family that did not express anger and never admitted to it. It was always a polite family that tried to repress and deny anger. So that, from just that kind of cultural conditioning, and from family experience, my tendencies were to deny and suppress and to not know what to do with it. And then it would break out in sudden kind of explosions, like it's like the last straw that broke the camel's back. Suddenly you'd find yourself being utterly enraged over some minor little thing somebody did. And the person is completely overwhelmed because they think, well, I didn't really do anything that bad. They don't realize it's the last straw. It might be little, last straw is not very much, but it's the last one you can take. Anger is then, we tend to feel guilty when we feel it, one shouldn't feel, especially towards, your parent. I was brought up to, you should not feel this towards people you love, and that anger was a sign that you didn't love somebody. And so there's a tremendous guilt also, feeling that when there was anger, that this destroyed the relationship. And so there is always an attempt to deny and suppress this emotion, which made it very difficult to relate to anyone very well, because in any relationship, as you all are very probably aware of, any loving relationship will include anger in it. And all parent-children relationships are filled with this emotion. It's inevitable. It's not to be despised or to be feared, but to be understood. In monastic life, in all the kind of goodness and purity of the monastic ideal, there's a lot of anger in it. A lot of anger in the restraint of it, in the hierarchical structures of it, in the personal reactions to it. In the restraint of it, anything that restrains and keeps you from doing what you want tends to create anger, resentment. And so the Buddha did establish monastic discipline in a very seemingly severe way, in which a very highly developed kind of disciplinary system which holds you down, keeps you from doing what you're used to doing, or saying what you're used to saying, or expressing what you're used to, what you want to express. You're having to conform to a limitation. You're having to live within limits, and that can bring up a lot of anger and resentment. Living with in a community of other monks and with nuns, with novices and lay people, there's endless problems all the time in dealing with people's emotions, because the just personality clashes. Different nationalities live together. There are just so many different personality types, tendencies, age groups. We have Asian and monks and nuns and European ones, and all these things bring up a certain amount of problems into our life. Just the differences on the level of our individual differences and all the rest. So we contemplate, what did the Buddha have in mind then, if he established this discipline, and he wanted us to understand the forces that motivate us and that course through our minds in our conscious experience. We are to understand these things rather than to just suppress. And I noticed when I first became a monk, I didn't quite understand this very well. So there was a lot of suppression, trying to conform to the monastic ideal as what I was used to doing with my life was conforming to ideals, trying to live up to ideals. And then always feeling guilty and feeling a failure because I could never quite get there. I mean, once in a while, it seemed like you could kind of live according to the ideal, but most of the time you had to cope with lesser kind of emotions, not the ideal. I mean, we couldn't live on just pure metta, loving kindness and compassion and total selflessness and all-encompassing love and pure wisdom. One had very trivial, very nasty, very unpleasant things that could go through one's mind that made one feel very unworthy and as a person, because the attachment was to an ideal of how I should be and what I wanted to be. But then in practicing with that, following the teachings of the Buddha, one became increasingly aware that the only thing you could ever really do was to understand. This is what the Buddha was pointing out in his teaching of the Four Noble Truths. The first truth is to understand the suffering. So understanding is our ability to admit into our consciousness what we're feeling, being able to accept it for what it is. Because to understand something, you have to accept it first. You can't understand something that you refuse to accept. If you already reject it and hate it and want to deny it and get rid of it, then you cannot understand it. You can't understand anger if you're always trying to get rid of it or deny it or suppress it. And so therefore, because you don't understand it, it's always kind of laying there, kind of latent tendencies of the mind to get angry. And one can feel that. You meet people who spend their lives avoiding situations that would arouse anger because they don't want to feel it. They don't want to have to feel that emotion. in admitting it, one thing, it's a painful experience to actually admit that you feel anger, because maybe your life has been spent thinking that I'm not really angry. Trying to convince yourself that this isn't the real problem. And then to admit it is in some ways a relief. And we find that in a community it helps to admit it to somebody else, because somehow when we kind of confess to somebody else who's willing to listen, not condemn us for it, we can see it in a better way. Somehow it kind of helps us to really accept it. If we can confess it. And so one way we can help each other deal with anger is to listen to each other rather than lecture to each other. For example, we say, you shouldn't feel angry, you should feel loving kindness. And we already know that. We know what we should feel and what we'd like to feel. But if this is what I'm feeling, it may not be what I want, but it's what I'm feeling. And if I can talk about it to somebody else and they'll just more or less listen sympathetically, then that helps to see it and to accept it. Because in that acceptance of something that frightens you or worries you, or that you feel guilty about, in that acceptance, then you can let it go. Now, I've talked a lot about letting go as that is a very attractive subject to people, because people really, would like to let go of anger. And it's something that we would most want to do, is to let it go. But actually what we're doing is we're wanting to get rid of it. And letting go, when I use that term, it doesn't mean getting rid of, because getting rid of always brings into our consciousness that sense of aversion and of non-acceptance of something. We refuse to accept it. We just want to get it out of the way because we don't like it. So when we think we're letting go, but we're really trying to get rid of something, get rid of anger, it doesn't really work. We can kind of fool ourselves sometimes thinking that we've really let it go, but we haven't, because we haven't really accepted it yet. So when we become aware of this, then we begin to see the possibilities of accepting anger, willing to feel anger without being caught in the anger. And this is quite a difficult thing to really understand sometimes, how we can accept our feeling and to willingly feel this emotion and accept it when it's present, but not act on it, not speak nor physically act on it, or to reject it. So this is like the human mind in its reflective state, where the emotion is one thing, it feels this way, and our ability to observe it, to acknowledge it, to bear it, to endure this the heat of it, or the misery of it, or the frightening feelings that we might be having in regards to it, the fear of it, to accept all of that. I talk about embracing it, and like, because when you take on the whole of it, when you embrace something, you're taking it all on. You're not just picking and choosing. You're embracing the whole of it. and willing to suffer with it, willing to experience the misery of it. Then we can let it go, which doesn't mean we throw it out the window, but it means that it goes because it's impermanent. We don't have to make it go because its nature is to go. And as soon as we decide we want it to go, then we get caught in the aversion. We don't want this thing anymore. We want to get rid of it. And so we get caught into the repression again or denial. In teaching meditation to people here over the years, on the people, because it is a country where people are well educated and intelligent, and they understand the theory very, very easily. But how to put that into practice is the real challenge. Because one part of you understands, but when the actual experience comes, then that's the testing ground. And since anger is always a sign of impatience, and we don't have enough patience to experience the pain or the suffering or the unpleasantness of it, and we want to get rid of it. With mindfulness, then we become aware of the process of the maybe we to admit that we want to get rid of it is a way of understanding that, and contemplating and willing to note what it does to the body, to your body when there's anger in the mind, what your body feels like is a good object for reflection. To mindfully reflect on the effect it has on you physically, so that when you feel angry or outraged or indignant about something, you bring attention to, say, here, to your heart or to the trunk of your body. And then ask yourself, what does it feel like? It doesn't help very much to analyze it, because our analytical abilities usually reinforce a sense of it being a problem. So in Buddhist meditation, we're trying to put it in its proper perspective, not as a personal problem, but as it really is. It's something that has arisen, and what has arisen will cease. And we're putting it in the perspective of Dhamma, of the way it is, rather than what we think it is on the level of our conditioning. Like when we think of ourselves as a person, we tend to think, if anger is a problem, we think, I'm an angry person, or I'm feeling anger and I shouldn't be angry, or this is a bad thing and I'm shouldn't be feeling this emotion. When we analyze ourselves, we get stuck in that whole way of thinking, that because the conditioned thought patterns are very much affirmations of self. This is me, this is my problem. But when regarded in terms of Dhamma, or the way it is, then you're getting outside the conditioning of your mind, your own way of interpreting anger on a personal level, to seeing it as the experience itself, what it feels like, and what it actually is, and it's impermanent. And we're looking at it as non-self rather than self. We're seeing it as a condition in nature that has arisen. And then we know that what arises ceases. So then because of that, we can endure. We're willing to bear it. We're willing to feel it. We are willing to endure the experience because we're confident and we know in terms of Dhamma that it is what it is, and we're willing to understand it and to accept it and to leave it alone or let it go. And then the conditions are there for it to cease. And we're letting it cease. We're not making it go away. And in this reflective mode, we're using wisdom. We begin to understand this force. And in that way, then the energy is not being acted on. We're not being caught in a karmic connection to it. We're not acting or suppressing, but we're releasing. We're letting go. We're aware of it in terms of what it really is. And so we're not making any personal karma with it. We're learning how to resolve anger, how to release it, and how to do it in a skillful way so that it becomes less and less of a problem for us. Where at one time we might have thought it's the obstruction to our enlightenment. It's an obstacle that we can't overcome. But when really understood in its proper way, then we realize it's one of our teachers. Something we have to learn from these things. We have them, we experience these things, because they're important for us to understand. Look at it like that. Whatever emotions you have, whatever way you are, it's rather than seeing it in terms of obstructions that prevent you, or misfortunes or bad karma, change the attitude to one of this is I must learn from this. What can I learn from this? Because if we begin to review our life as this opportunity to learn from it, to learn about truth and be liberated from just the forces of ignorance and delusion that otherwise we're victims of if we don't start looking at things in a different way. Wisdom helps us to change our attitude. And I found it very helpful to things that I don't like or don't want. Things that I dread, those very thoughts or imaginings of the mind, the possibility. If I follow my conditioning of my mind, then I can worry, I can get anxious, I can avoid. Confronting situations, I try to get out of things. I become cowardly and frightened because I think I can't bear it. I can't stand it. I don't want to experience that or know that or see that. Then contemplating that feeling of wanting to avoid or get away from what I don't like or what I'm frightened of, I change my attitude. I think I must learn from this. I must be willing to accept it. I will try to feel it rather than avoid feeling. I'm going to determine to feel it and to accept what I'm feeling. And I found just by changing my attitude from one of avoidance and fear and trying to get out of situations that might bring up unpleasant possibilities, one feels more willing to go directly into things, to do what one has to do, to learn from life. And it's humbling because you're not always going to succeed. A lot of it, you're going to make terrible mistakes, but you can keep learning. And that's why the determination is necessary, not to, you think you're going to conquer it all at once and then you're going to live happily ever after. But to keep kind of willing, being willing to learn, no matter how many times you might fail at it, or how you might humiliate yourself, or how, you know, you might be not be able to be as brave and as wise and as clear as you imagine you should be. That's why I, talking to people about anger, and they say, well, I tried what you said, and I did get angry, but I grew up anyway. And I said terrible things. I couldn't stop it. I was trying to accept it. No. And then I asked, well, at what point did you really, did you realize what you were doing? And, well, after it was all over and I said all these things or did this terrible thing, then suddenly I realized, and then I felt terribly guilty, and I felt despair because I'm just hopeless. I can't do it. And so then you point to the fact, at that point where you catch yourself, you start from there. Maybe you can't stop the anger, but at any point of that experience, both during its active time or the despair or guilt afterwards, once you realize what's happened and you accept that and notice that and really to feel what you're feeling, then you're actually beginning to break the pattern down. Rather than sinking into despair and self-aversion and disappointment, which doesn't do anyone any good, is of no use and no help to anyone, that point of where you collect yourself, then you start again and make that determination not to stop it, not to control it, but to understand it, and so recognize that it's connected in a kind of, it has its own momentum. Anger and that emotion, and then the guilt that follows it is connected to it. So it's all part of a pattern that you can reflect upon. And by any place, any point where you observe it and understand it is the beginning to really accept it and understand it. It's not like like a failure if you. You only fail if you hold to the view that you are a failure. If you're determined to cling to that, then and no one can change your mind. Then, but that isn't that is a realm you can also lift yourself out of if by changing your attitude. The challenge of this age, isn't it, is one feels at this time, this the 90s of the 20th century, it's a rather threatening time, I think, for most people, because the structures that most of us have become used to are all kind of falling apart. And we find ourselves in we see the what happened, say, in the former Soviet Union or in Yugoslavia or places that have been under a very kind of oppression, strong oppression, where anger, resentments have never been properly resolved. They've just been suppressed. Through a very strong police state and fear from a centralized power, people will behave and drop these issues about ethnic differences and things of the past or religious differences. Because then, you know, we're all being oppressed by the same tyrant, and our anger can kind of leak out towards that. But once that tyrant is gone, then we're none the wiser for it unless we've resolved anger within our own minds. And so then we easily slide back into the old karmic patterns of hating those people over there, or if you those Bosnian Muslims, or you know what they're like, or the you know what they did under the Turks, and how they oppressed the Serbs, and how our ancestors told us all the things that they used to do, and groups in the Caucasus and countries that we never even heard of before till recently. Abkhazia, I never heard of Abkhazia in my life. Now it's big print in a newspaper. Sukhumi sounds like a Pali word. You think the capital of Abkhazia is Sukhumi. That sounds like a Pali word. That's a name for a woman in Thailand. That's the capital of Abkhazia. All these kind of magical names in exotic places start rising in consciousness, and we don't even know why Abkhazians don't want to be part of Georgia, or why the Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh want to free themselves from the Azerbaijanis, and but we can realize in our own life how things will come up when suddenly certain other difficult situations, tensions of our life are released, then other things come up. It's interesting in monastic life with people coming to live the ideal monastic life here at Amravati or Chithurst, and they get out of maybe unpleasant situations that they were in before, and they come to this community and they find, you know, they're looking forward to it as a kind of place where everything's going to be much better, and yet their life here will bring up all the resentments that they've had in their life. You know, because the pressures are the way that the life is lived is constructed in such a way that everything seems to come up into your consciousness. Because you don't because of the restraint of it, you don't have a lot of distractions that you can use, or like television or drinking or all the kind of ways, sensual pleasures, eating whenever you want, or going wherever you want to do, or choosing who you want to be with. Those kind of things you can't do that anymore. So you're more or less stuck with yourself and the people you're with in a way that is going to allow a lot of repressed emotions into your consciousness. And of course, one of those emotions that everybody experiences is anger. In public, we all look very beautiful, I think. We put on our angelic smiles and people say, oh, they're so lovely, those monks. And actually, I'm very proud of this community because it learns. The monks and nuns here do learn. They're not wasting their lives, and they're not, just idling away, doing nothing, because they've actually learning how to do this, and it takes time. And they're increasingly more skillful at it. I think we all are increasingly much more skillful and capable than we were, say, 10 years ago. But that's because we're determined to develop this life and to to use it to understand the Dhamma, to realize the Dhamma, and to understand the suffering and how to resolve the suffering in our lives, how to let it go, and how to realize the way of non-suffering. And it's difficult even under conditions like this, where you've got kind of very nice people and pleasant situation to live in. And one really understands the difficulties of say, and here in Britain, a very nice country. And you think, you know, it's a stable, and even though the newspapers would never admit it, it's a fairly well-run country. It's not as bad as everyone thinks. And and still, with all that going for us, we can still be make a hell realm of our minds. Even when everything on the external side is very good. And then we consider countries like the Russia and the countries that were in the Soviet Union and the problems that they have. You can understand why, you know, these things arise. They're dealing with all the repressed anger and resentments that have never been properly understood or dealt with in their lives by their families or their own group or their nation. Under the old Soviet system, you just held it down, you know, squashed everything, because you didn't dare say too much or express anything about ethnicity or anything like that, because you get sent off to a prison camp or some dreadful fate. They had no compunction about killing people who didn't agree. And here in Britain, when one hears the problems with crime, and I hear they're planning to build 6 more prisons to accommodate all the criminals. That's what they do in America. They don't try to cure the causes of crime. They just try to build more prisons to accommodate more and more criminals. It's like council housing or something. And you think, you know, you contemplate, why do we have such problems in our society? You know, rather than looking at it as something we've got to wipe out or just control through punishment and through trying to just suppress that criminal energy. Maybe there's a better way to do it. You know, like how to deal with anger in our lives. This is something that you know, whether we're criminals or non-criminals, we all get angry. And criminals, I imagine, are those who have acted on anger or resentment and fear and their greed and so forth. And then they act on it. They tend rather, and maybe they've been driven to where the last straw triggered off some criminal act. And so when we contemplate the way things are and we see the challenges for us at this time are really, for one thing, to be able to resolve this within ourselves. We can't expect someone else to do it if we can't. Is it? That's hypocrisy. Say you should be doing it for me. You should be controlling and dealing and resolving your anger so that you don't get angry to me and don't upset me. It's a kind of what they call the Jewish mother syndrome. Don't do anything that upsets me. And then that's not fair, is it? It's not right to expect somebody else to do it. because it's something we need to do. We need to, or that we can do. And it's something very good to do. And people need to know that they can do it. They need to have that encouragement. And I think in many cases now we find people much more open to this. I find, like modern, say not so much from my generation, but the ones that followed, there's a tremendous interest and openness towards these things. And like here in the community, the monks and nuns are all, you know, generation and several generations younger than I am, and they're certainly more. Seem to be more willing to deal with these things, these issues, and to take an interest in them. Then, living in a community, we begin to find the joy of it in being able to help, to cooperate, to learn how to expand our minds to acceptance of variety and eccentricity and idiosyncrasy, rather than just wanting everything to control everything in a pattern that doesn't offend or worry us. We begin to appreciate variety of character and ability, and not feel it's a threat to our own security. And so the human heart is one that is. It can be liberated from the force of anger, and that very energy then is released into and channeled through this, so that we begin to feel a sense of being invigorated by life, because we're not caught in just violent expressions, uncontrollable explosions, or in just the dreariness of suppression and rejection, but we began to feel a sense of vitality and awareness and interest in this experience of consciousness that we're all involved in at this time. So I offer this as a reflection for this afternoon. And now is the time to have tea. And then 15, 20 minutes, we can all reassemble for any further discussion.